Welcome to Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. Season 8 of Jury Duty explores the trial of Alex Murdoch, a member of one of the most powerful families in South Carolina, who is accused of murdering his son Paul and his wife Maggie with the purpose of covering up a multitude of alleged crimes, including fraud and homicide. In our last episode, we continued our look at the testimony of Maggie Murdoch's older sister, Marion Proctor, and we covered a hearing on the admissibility of certain aspects of the witness's testimony. In this installment, we will begin by presenting Judge Newman's decision on the admissibility of that testimony. We will then conclude our review of Ms. Proctor's testimony, and we will cover the testimony of her husband, Barton Proctor. That's all coming up right after the break.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
It is the late afternoon of February 14th, 2023, day 15 of the trial of Alex Murdoch. As we concluded our last episode, the prosecution and the defense argued over the admissibility of a particular portion of Marion Proctor's testimony. Ms. Proctor had testified that there was a general state of fear among members of the Murdochs' extended family after the murders of Maggie and Paul. The defense objected when the state asked Ms. Proctor about a change in her perception of the defendant's state of mind regarding that ongoing danger. As we begin this installment, Judge Newman renders his decision on the matter.
The witness can testify as to her concern as to what occurred on September 7th that changed her concern about Alex living in fear. She cannot testify as to on the fidelity issue because that's too remote in time and would tend to confuse the jury. She can testify that she discovered that he'd been fired and that he had a drug problem.
Your Honor, depending on how the testimony goes, we would have hearsay objections if she's testifying as to what someone told
her. She's not testifying as to the truth of it. She's responding to why her concerns were changed based on, in part, of her conversations with you.
No, I understand.
For Mr. Murdoch.
Well, I understand that. My point I just stood to address is the family wrestling with opioid and pill use by the defendant. That is hearsay. If that's how she knows.
She already had a drug problem. I mean, if you want to talk about specifically, I don't know to what degree she discovered his drug problem or opioid addiction or whatever it is, but it's already in evidence anyway.
No, I understand. I'm just advising the court that I will be making hearsay objections if that's testified about hearsay.
Anything else before the jury comes?
That's from the state this time, Your Honor.
All right, bring the jury.
With Judge Newman's announcement of his decision, the jury re-enters the courtroom and Prosecutor Creighton Waters continues his redirect of the witness.
The objection's overruled. You may continue.
Ms. Proctor, when we left on the break, I was asking you what happened in September that caused you to change your assessment. Can you describe that to the jury, please?
On September 4th, we were headed to a football game, and my husband, Bart, received a phone call from a friend saying he was so sorry to hear about what had happened to my brother-in-law. And we had no idea what he was talking about. And he said, well, we've heard, you know, he told us he had been shot. So we pulled over on the side of the road. We were all in hysterics. We called Buster, and Buster said yes, that his dad had been shot, that he was being airlifted to the hospital, that they thought hoped he was going to be okay. So we wanted more information, so we called Jim Griffin, and he told us that Alec had been shot in the head and that he had been fired from his law firm for stealing.
What was your concern when you heard that he had been shot?
Initially, I thought he might be dead. I had just lost two of the family members, and I felt like they were being targeted at that point. I felt like the family was being targeted.
Subsequent to that, did your concern that the family was being targeted, did that change as well?
Over the course of a few weeks, we were still on high alert, worried for Buster, but at that point, information started coming out about some things that Alec had done financially that we had no idea about.
And that changed your assessment about what you heard about him being shot as well, is that correct? Can you answer out loud?
The shooting, that was an event in itself, the roadside shooting.
You just stated that the shooting itself, the roadside shooting, was an event in itself. Did other information come to your attention that changed your assessment about the roadside shooting at a later time?
Yes.
And changed that initial concern that Alec was somehow being targeted?
Yes.
Did Maggie have a nickname for Paul?
As Little Detective.
Little Detective?
Mm-hmm.
And what did that mean?
She felt like that he was always looking to make sure his dad was behaving.
And what specifically was the concern?
Pills, prescription pain pills.
And had Maggie expressed to you concern over time about the defendant's pill usage?
Yes.
How long had that been going on?
I am not sure, but I think it had been going on for some time.
And did that concern continue up until recent times as we moved to their Maggie and Paul's murder?
Yes.
And what did specifically Little Detective mean as it related to the pills?
If there were pills in the house that his dad was taking that he wasn't supposed to, Paul was determined that he would find them.
And did that happen on occasions?
I think so, yes.
What specifically changed your perception of the roadside shooting after your initial concern?
The story that was initially told about what happened came to not be true.
The story told by who?
Alec.
By Alec?
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that, Marion Proctor steps down from the witness stand. The state next calls Ms. Proctor's husband, Barton Proctor, who goes by Bart. Mr. Proctor is in his early 60s. He is clean-shaven, sports dark hair parted on his left, and wears a blue-gray suit, a white dress shirt, and a gold patterned tie. Creighton Waters handles the questioning for the prosecution.
Good afternoon. Very quickly, tell the jury, are you Marion Proctor's husband?
For 37 years.
Obviously, over the years, being part of this family, have you gotten to know Maggie and gotten to know Paul and gotten to know the defendant, Alec Murdaugh?
I have.
I don't want to belabor the points, but in the aftermath of Maggie and Paul's murder, were you also privy to some of the conversations that Alec had that your wife related to this jury today?
Yes.
And ultimately heard the same thing in those conversations that she related here today?
Yes.
Have you had an opportunity to review what's been entered into evidence as State's 297, the kennel video?
I have heard it.
Creighton Waters displays the oft-played kennel video for Mr. Proctor. In the video, which was recorded by Paul Murdaugh, we see a dog named Cash. Numerous witnesses have identified the three voices heard in the background of the video as belonging to Paul, Maggie, and Alex Murdaugh.
Do you recognize any voices on that video?
I recognize three.
Can you tell the jury what voices you recognize?
I recognize Paul Murdaugh. I recognize Maggie Murdaugh. And I recognize Alec Murdaugh.
And when you say Alec Murdaugh, do you see him in the courtroom here today?
I do.
Can you point him out for the jury, please?
Yes,
or
sir.
Describe him.
He's wearing a blue blazer and has his glasses on his head.
And how sure are you?
100%.
Thank you. Please answer any questions the defense may have.
With that, Creighton Waters concludes his direct examination of Mr. Proctor.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Defense Attorney Jim Griffin rises for a brief cross-examination of the witness.
Hey, Mr. Proctor. Were you ever shown a blue raincoat by any SLED agents?
Yes, sir.
And was that blue raincoat shown to you and your wife, Marion, who just was here in the courtroom?
Yes, sir. It's a picture.
A picture of the blue raincoat. And did you recognize the blue raincoat?
No, sir.
Had you ever seen it before?
No, sir.
Did you ever see Paul wear it, the blue raincoat?
I had never recognized it before.
Okay. All right. That's all the questions I have, Your Honor.
Anything further?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
With that, Barton Proctor steps down from the witness stand. Creighton Waters explains to Judge Clifton Newman that a circumstance prevented his next witness from appearing in court, and so Newman dismisses the jury for the day. After the jury leaves the courtroom, Waters brings up a matter regarding the roadside shooting of the defendant, which occurred several months after the murders, and soon after evidence of Alex Murdoch's financial crimes was uncovered by his former law firm, PMPED.
Your Honor, I will say that with the, you know, the side of the road issue has always been out there, and at this point, we believe there is some admissibility as to that, particularly a statement of the defendant related to that, in which there's actually a few statements, but there's one statement in particular. I don't know if Your Honor wants to proffer that at this particular time, since we have a little time available outside the jury's presence, but I do think that at some point that's a bridge, given developments that needs to be crossed.
Judge Newman asks Waters to clarify the state's theory of why such evidence should be admitted.
And what is the state's theory of admissibility of the roadside shooting?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. As we argued back in December and as argued in those particular briefs, what we see is a chain of circumstances that are connected for an extended period of time that particularly highlight and start in June 7th. We've gone into, obviously, Your Honor, moving into the financial situation as it went into July and the efforts to shore up that particular money, the loans. Mr. Burney testified to that today. But of course, Mr. Murdoch, there's already been evidence admitted that he was $192,000 short and that Chris Wilson covered that. The evidence goes on that in that particular interim of time, and again with the state's theory, that he's able to do his best to try to cover things up in that interim period. But then everything comes to a head, as already has been testified to, in September 4th. Chris Wilson, of course, has also already testified that particular day on September 4th, that he finally got the defendant to agree to meet with him and confronted him about that 192, which again is right at the heart of the Ferris feeds, which are right at the heart of June 7th, 2021, and had that confrontation with him. The admissions that were made have already been testified to, and then with a short period of time in response to that, that the side of the road shooting happened. You've already heard testimony here from Ms. Proctor that, of course, the initial reaction of everyone is, oh my gosh, the real killers are back. And that's precisely, under the state's theory, the effect that the defendant intended. And there will be, from these recorded statements, ultimately evidence offered that was not true, and he had told lies, Your Honor, about that particular. And that would be the recorded statement that we would offer about when he admitted that he had been untruthful to law enforcement about the circumstances of that shooting. I don't intend to go into great detail about that. I'm just trying to get from point A to point B and then get out. I'm not trying to use the term that I've used before, gild the lily.
Judge Newman gives Dick Harpootlian the opportunity to respond for the defense.
And the gist of the recorded statement is is what, Mr.
Your Hoffman? Honor.
Okay, so Mr. Murdaugh had somebody shoot him in the head on the roadside to have a $10 or $12 million insurance policy paid to his son, Buster. Now, he believed it was a suicide contestability cause, so he had somebody shoot him in the head. No question they shot him in the head. No question the intent was to kill him. He fractured his skull, had a brain bleed, was airlifted to Savannah Hospital. It didn't kill him. He intended to die. And the recorded statement, he immediately went to detox because he was planning to go to detox anyway. Mr. Griffin and I went down to Atlanta. We met with him in detox. He'd been through a horrible experience, shot in the head, and then detox. And we informed him the police were looking for whoever shot him. And he, at that point, said, look, this is what happened. And I don't want them wasting, and literally, he said, I don't want them wasting resources trying to solve this shooting when those resources could be used to find who killed Maggie and Paul. We picked up the phone. We called SWED. We put him on the phone with SWED to have him explain exactly what happened. This wasn't a result of a SWED interrogation. This was a voluntary statement. So they quit wasting resources looking for them. And he told them who shot him in the head, and a guy named Eddie Smith, who was his drug dealer. So that's...
And you all brought his name up a couple of times through cross-examination. Is he on the state's witness list?
Yes, Your Honor.
But, Your Honor, one aspect of that, and I think this is what highlights the relevance and the connection with this particular case, is that in the wake of the side of the road shooting, Mr. Murdaugh's initial claim was that some unknown individual had a flat tire, and some unknown individual, supposedly under the guise of stopping for help, then suddenly shot him in the head. He went so far as to draw a composite photograph. Again, I'm not trying to get into too much of the detail, but that, of course, the immediate effect of that is that he's been targeted by some unknown individual. That was a complete lie, and that's the point of that statement.
If the issue here is that Mr. Murdaugh lies, I mean, really, are we at that? I mean, we've come $10 million through lies, and now this piece of evidence becomes relevant because it proves he lied again months after the murder. There's no, you know, he didn't do it, and I think they will concede he didn't do it to get some sort of sympathy. He did it to be dead. That's why he did it. And unfortunately, Eddie Smith, at 4 feet, couldn't shoot somebody in the head and kill him. He meant to.
And that's what Mr. Smith would say?
Mr. Smith has given no less, I'm set up to cross-examine him, I know this, 6 different explanations for that and any other event you ask him about, from wasn't there to I was there and I saw Alec, he'd been shot, to I was there and I tried to stop Alec, yes, I shot him in the head. But the fact of the matter is, the cross-examination of Mr. Smith is something I'm looking forward to now. But this particular event had nothing to do with what happened on June 7, other than he lied about something else. And 404, unless there's a specific, it's not motive, I mean, I don't understand what the 404-403 analysis would be on this. I know what the 403 analysis is. The prejudice outweighs the probative. The 404 is, what of the 4 things that 404 is admitted for, which one is this?
Your Honor.
I know you all want to argue it in the morning, so this is just a prelude to tomorrow morning.
Two things. If Mr. Harpootlian wishes to stipulate in front of the jury that his client is a liar, the state's willing to accept that stipulation.
Can I go forward with this?
The second thing is, Your Honor, is that what actually happened on the side of the road is not what's important to this particular case. What is important, Your Honor, is that it's in reaction to the confrontation with Chris Wilson about the Ferris fees that came to the head on June 7th, 2021, and it's about what the defendant said, that he was attacked by an unknown assailant as he was trying to change a tire, and went so far as to do a composite drawing, and it created the effect, as this case had, as this investigation had gone on, that, oh my gosh, the real killers are back to finish the job. And that's precisely what he intended, and he ultimately admitted that was a lie. So the circumstances of what happened on the side of the road are not what the state is focused on. What is important is what the defendant said, how he attempted to use that, and that it was actually a falsehood. And it had, and you heard Ms. Proctor testify, it had that exact effect, that, oh my gosh, the real killers are back.
But I think the state can see his object on the side of the road was to be dead. That's what the act was, to kill himself. Now, what happened after that, after he was taken to Savannah and had a brain bleed and a fractured skull, and when he came out of all that and realized, I'm not dead, how is that relevant to June 7th? Your Honor, we can beat this dead horse a little bit more in the morning, but allow us to give you, I don't know, this crazy idea of giving you maybe some more law to look at.
Judge Newman decides to hear formal arguments on the admissibility of evidence related to the roadside shooting the next morning, and brings to a close day 15 of the trial. We resume the morning of February 15th, 2023. Prosecutor Creighton Waters opens the day by making his formal argument regarding the admissibility of evidence related to the roadside shooting of Alex Murdaugh.
Your Honor, and I sent a memo early this morning. Hopefully you've had a chance to see that. A lot of it reiterates what we had previously filed in our prior motions. And again, as it relates to this particular evidence, as I argued yesterday, consciousness of guilt is a very recognized class of evidence as admissible evidence of motive and identity in South Carolina courts. Obviously, that we've cited a number of cases in more classic senses of consciousness of guilt evidence, such as, you know, witness intimidation, flight. But any sort of evasive action, any sort of action to evade detection or throw off the scent, has been admissible in our courts. Your Honor, I see the clerk from Barnwell here, and I had a murder case in front of her not too long ago, or well, it's been a while. But in any event, in that particular case, the defendant had actually found in his car was a voodoo root. That said, had on there, protect me from murder charges, save me, Judge Early, protect me from murder charges. And ultimately, that was admitted and, in an unpublished opinion, affirmed as evidence of consciousness of guilt and evasive conduct because of what it meant to the defendant. And so I just point that out as an example as to how expansive that can be. When we look at this case, and again, one thing about this case, Your Honor, is it's intricate and complex on a scale that I think none of us have ever seen. And so we have to look at it within that vein and in that context. And what we have here, Your Honor, and why this is relevant evidence of consciousness of guilt, it really doesn't matter what exactly happened on the side of the road, because that's not the focus of what the state is seeking to do. What the state is seeking to do and what we believe is relevant and admissible under these rules is to show what the defendant said about it and the fact that was not true. And what he said about it, of course, was that he was on the side of the road, he had a flat tire with a car that has run flats, that he was changing the tire, and that a nice-looking, nice man stopped offering help, and then all of a sudden he was shot in the back of the head. And obviously, the initial reaction we've heard from Ms. Proctor, we've heard and can hear from other witnesses, and the initial reaction was that, oh my gosh, the real killers are back, the bad guys are back, they've now targeted Alec. And the other thing that's crucial about this that connects it all together is not only does he make that claim, that statement about being targeted by an unknown assailant, as things were heating up on him in this investigation, that then causes people to immediately assume that he's been targeted and it has nothing, in no way could he be responsible for Moselle. But we also have to look at the symmetry of this particular event with what happened on June the 7th. And on June the 7th, as we know, and Your Honor's heard extensive testimony, both in camera and in this trial, he is confronted about the fares fees that morning. There's all kinds of circumstances that have been put into evidence that are moving as to a perfect storm arriving on that day. And, of course, what happens that night? Maggie and Paul are murdered. The community rallies. Everything changes. We have the same thing happening on September 3rd and September 4th, because finally, despite his best efforts, the law firm has become privy and wise to what's been going on with his years of embezzlement and theft. they confront him. But more importantly, if we go back to those Ferris fees, which are very crucial and temporally connected to everything that happened on June 7th, is the fact that you've heard testimony from Chris Wilson that he is calling Mr. Murdoch, trying to get to meet with him because he wants to know what's up. He particularly wants to know what about the $192,000 of those Ferris fees that he covered for Mr. Murdoch. And they have that confrontation on the porch of Alameda that afternoon or early, right before noon, as was testified to. And what happens? Yet again, within a couple of hours, the side of the road happens, and everyone is rushing to Alec Murdoch's aid again. The fact that he had just been exposed for embezzlement is quickly forgotten about, and of course everybody's assuming, oh my gosh, it must be the real bad guys, when in fact it was him all along. And so that is extremely relevant evidence, and it's also been, just to add into the calculus, Your Honor, is we do have the concept of what's been opened the door, what issues have been joined by the defense and put up here. And of course, that's how this issue all arose yesterday with the testimony of Ms. Marion Proctor. So we think it's very admissible as clear consciousness of guilt evidence. It's admissible under 404. I've also argued, without getting in great detail, when we talk about that symmetry, we talk about common scheme or plan. And again, this isn't the kind of common scheme or plan that is typical, but we have to look at this case through a lens that recognizes just the intricacies and the complexity of a set of circumstances like we've never seen. And so all those legal theories, Your Honor, we would assert justify admission of this evidence. I will also say that this express this to the defense, that it's the state's intent to really quickly move from point A to point B. We are not here to try to litigate what happened on the side of the road in its entirety. I believe that the testimony about this could be done in just over an hour, and that includes playing the recorded statement. There's a number of recorded statements, not trying to play all of those. It would just be simply having the agent come in, relate the story that Alec Murdoch told to 911 and told to law enforcement, that initial story about the unknown assailant, the fact that the investigation continued and additional information came to light that conflicted with that, and that he was eventually confronted with that. And then there's a recorded statement at the end in which he admits that, in fact, what he had told law enforcement was a lie. And so it would be a very focused presentation to just get from point A to point B for purposes of this trial and the relevance that it has to this trial. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would assert that limited presentation is admissible for those purposes.
Dick Harpootlian responds for the defense.
The state, and we agree, the state versus Cartwright would be applicable to this situation. And it has four criteria about a suicide. They seem to think that the unmistakable nexus exists by clear and convincing evidence linking the suicide attempt to a guilty conscience about the murder. The facts are that he was confronted by the law firm on Friday, fired on Friday, and then persuades, I don't know if much persuasion was needed, Eddie Smith to shoot him in the head, thinking that it would get his son, Buster Murdoch, $12 million in insurance money that would otherwise be excluded by the suicide exemption in his insurance policy. So all this is linked to is the financial crime, not the murder. We're here trying to murder. And yet all the evidence, not all, but a significant amount of the evidence we've heard over the last 3.5 weeks has been about the financial crime. This is guilty knowledge of the financial crimes, not the murder. And this under 404, 403 analysis under Cartwright would not be admissible. I'd further say this. If he's looking for a common scheme, that is that when he's about to be found out or he's being found out, he would have killed Buster based on his theory to distract. This isn't a distraction. This is an end. And clearly, you haven't heard the taped interview. That he initiated from Detox in Atlanta, in which he explained he was killing himself to get this money for Buster because his financial crimes had been found out. This is 3 months after the murder. This is in September. It's not connected by time. It's not temporal under the 404, 403 analysis, and certainly it's not evidence of guilty knowledge his own statement would indicate that nothing to do with the murder. It's only about the financial crimes. And he contacted Sweat
And on that recording, myself, Mr. Griffin, and Mr. Murdaugh, from detox, he finally had detoxed, wasn't on drugs anymore. And he has a great detailed statement about Eddie Smith buying the drugs for him over a number of years, millions of dollars worth, and how Eddie didn't hesitate to shoot him in the head on the side of the road. I don't know how that is relevant. Now, maybe the drug piece is, but they've got statements from Eddie Smith about what drugs he bought and what he did with those. So we would oppose going forward on any roadside shooting evidence. We think the prejudicial far outweighs the probative, and we'd ask Your Honor to not allow them to do that.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, very quickly, I do want to distinguish again between what Mr. Harpootlian keeps wanting to argue about, and that's the prospect of there being some sort of suicide on the side of the road. Again, the state's real focus is not exactly on what happened on the side of the road. What's important, and this is, I think, different from a typical court rate such situation, is what the defendant said about it, and the fact that he immediately tells this lie about him being targeted by an unknown assailant. And that is what directly connects it back to Moselle, and that's immediately what everybody assumed. The first thing that jumped in their mind is that connection back to Moselle. That connection in the next is unmistakable. So it's not as much about a traditional type of Cartwright analysis. That's not what I'm arguing here. What I'm arguing here is his explanation for what happened and the fact that that ultimately was not true. And that nexus, I believe, is very clear. I think the other one would be clear, too, but that former nexus is the stronger one, and that is the focus of what the state is trying to offer here today.
Your Honor, just briefly, this is character evidence, which is precluded. I mean, the only exception to 404, 403, Your Honor's allowed in, is motive. Why did he do it? And, I mean, it's just incredible, because if you put this up, you're going to hear from one of the SWAT agents when he woke up in the hospital in his skull had been fractured, he had a brain bleed. This is when he concocted that story. I mean, he expected never to wake up. So, you know, this was a scheme to draw out. No, if there was a scheme, it was created after Eddie Smith meant to shoot him. Actually, if he'd been a millimeter to the left, his brains would have been blown out. He just missed, but knocked him out, fractured his skull. That's all I have.
Your Honor, those are not the facts. He's telling that story at the scene to people who show up. He's out of the gate. That's what he's saying, that he was attacked by an unknown assailant. There's an ambulance video where the deputy comes in, and that's exactly the story he tells. This is not.
I would concede he's correct. Once he realizes he's still alive, he tells that story. But obviously, he didn't intend to be still alive. In other words, it's not a scheme that was concocted at any point. The scheme, if it's a scheme, was concocted after he realized he wasn't dead.
Judge Newman renders his decision on the matter.
Well, the financial evidence was allowed on the issue of motive. This evidence, I find, goes beyond motive, or is not evidence of motive, but more toward common scheme or plan. It does not survive the logical relevancy test, and it goes more towards showing the propensity to commit violent acts, which would cause it not to survive the 403 analysis. I believe that to allow this evidence is a bridge too far, going down this path of allowing essentially any and all evidence in. We have guardrails. The court is to place guardrails to keep things within a reasonable realm. And I believe this, as I stated, will be a bridge too far. It does not meet the logical relevancy test. I agree with the defense that it would be admissible, perhaps, if the trial was a trial on the financial theft issues, but not on the murder. So I grant the motion to exclude this evidence at this time. And of course, as we have seen, things change. Who knows?
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Please join us on our next installment as we begin our review of the testimony of SLED Special Agent David Owens, who interviewed Alex Murdaugh after the murders of Maggie and Paul. Also, check out the Ambie-nominated crime story podcast Night Raid, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty crime story Patreon page.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie and Tholis. It was co-produced, written, and edited by yours truly, Chris Terracone. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Trial audio is courtesy of Law & Crime Networks. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.